Cities are frustrating things. Not many melodic clarinets in reality. More traffic, pollution and noise. But for all their faults, they're popular and getting more so. Here are some figures. The United Nations Population Division estimates more than half the world's people now live in urban areas, with that percentage to rise to 70% by 2050. And in the developed world, the figure is already 74%. And here's another little factoid for you. The official population of Tokyo City is around the 13 million mark, but the population of what might be called Greater Tokyo, the city and its satellites, is around 35 million. Now that's what I call a city. Today, we'll hear about several initiatives designed to make city living more efficient in the future and to make the metropolis and its inhabitants more responsive to each other's needs. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome to Future Tense. But first, let's ponder the really big, obvious question. I say obvious, but it's a question that's rarely asked. Why, given all their faults, are cities so attractive to human beings? Dr. Luis Bettencourt is a theoretical physicist who works at the Santa Fe Institute and the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Now, he and his colleagues have been part of a massive data collection and analysis project, pulling together information from over 350 American cities and then looking for trends. So, why is city life, for all its congestion and noise, just so appealing?
I think it's one of the great questions in science and also maybe in society and in the way we understand ourselves, is why is it that we tend to come together in groups and in cities, ultimately? And how is it that cities and all the things that we do there is in some sense so much bigger than the individual contributions and actions of each one of us? So I was particularly very interested in sort of trying to understand people and sort of the social dimension of human societies. So when we started, it was sort of an opportunity to start thinking about why cities even exist, right? That should be the first question. And so the answer is sort of simple at once and also in some sense multifaceted. So it's simple because what cities do so well is that they in some sense amplify the capabilities and desires of each one of us, and they create this signal that you see in every nation throughout the world that economic productivity, measures of cultural output, all increase on a per capita basis as cities get larger and larger. And there's sort of actually even a quantitative, very distinctive signal to this, that it tends to increase in terms of more or less 10 to 20% when you measure any measure of economic activity like wages or income or GDP, when you measure things like scientific invention through patents, or even when you measure other cultural things. So that's one dimension in which cities are sort of amplifiers, concentrators, and actually in a very distinct sense, accelerators of human interaction and its products, both good and bad.
And it's that interaction that's important, isn't it? Because we're used to thinking, I guess, of cities as places that as they get bigger, they get scarier, that people become more divorced from each
right.
other, in a sense, if you like. But your research tends to indicate that what makes cities important, why they attract people, is that they foster interactions.
That's correct. But what you say is absolutely true as well, and that's what makes it both interesting and a little bit difficult. But it's also sort of the intuition, I think, that everyone has, and that's important. So when you put a lot of people together, then there's sort of an increased probability, but also an increased chance of people just meeting each other and doing new things, good and bad. And so you see, as I was saying, I was just talking about economic productivity, culture, et cetera. But it's also true of crime, for example. Crime is something that's pervasive in large cities, and it's something that also increases more or less by the same per capita rate as economic productivity. And in some sense, it's also a form, of course, of interpersonal interaction. What cities seem to do universally is really to amplify what humans do through interaction and catalyze those activities. And in some sense, the good and the bad come together in what seems to be sort of a unified package. The way we interpret this, and we're trying to study this in greater detail in more disaggregated ways, is that people, of course, are many different things. They are who they are, perhaps professionally, culturally, ethnically, in their personal lives, in terms of their attitude towards others, etc. And so the city basically allows people to interact across these many different dimensions. And so it's not so clear that we're just soup, that where interactions happen at greater concentrations in larger cities and the same things come out. So there are ways in which, for example, crime, as you were alluding to, can increase faster than the positive things. And in fact, the recent history of cities and the major crisis that cities, certainly in the United States, and for example now in Latin America, are having, have to do with insecurity and the fact that under the wrong conditions, so to speak, the ability of having many people interacting together becomes a barrel of gunpowder.
So from your perspective, the role of urban planning in the 21st century, that should be primarily focused on fostering those positive interactions between citizens.
Yes, definitely, which is not easy to do because in some sense the tradition of urban planning has been more to do with designing physical spaces and hoping that in some sense conditions the way people interact. It's one of those things, you know, in biology, typically people tend to say that form follows function, but function does not follow form usually. And so this is one of those instances where cities of many different forms in space, for example, tend to have similar economic outcomes as long as those can be realized by different ways of people moving around, et cetera. So we know, for example, in the United States, there are very clear examples that you have a place that's very prosperous, like Silicon Valley, San Jose, which is very suburban. And this is sort of the antithesis of the canonical, small-scale, very interactive city like, Manhattan or, of course, Old World City. Nevertheless, you know, if people can come together and there's sort of a buzz and the right mixture of people, and it's a safe place, usually cities do well. And they create, in fact, virtuous cycles in which those positive dimensions of human social activity, for example, in technology or in certain forms of culture or arts, tend to attract more people like that and amplify the effect. But that also runs in the opposite direction. So cities that usually start allowing for higher crime rates and violence, those tend to lose people that could stop the effect, and this also snowballs in the wrong direction. That's, for example, what happened in Detroit. So it's very interesting that cities can, you should really think them as processes. We were talking about human social interaction. That's, in some sense, that the elementary reactions, these reactions come across many different economic, social, and other dimensions. And so the city catalyzes them, but they can live in different concentrations and lead to an amplification of good things or an amplification of bad things.
Now, when most of us think about cities, we tend to focus on what makes them different, what makes them unique. But according to the research that Professor Bettencourt and his colleagues have undertaken, cities of the same size tend to be remarkably similar and predictable.
There's some things that are more predictable than others. So what we find is that the size of the city population, which we think ultimately is a proxy for how much people interact, it's basically like a macroscopic parameter that's telling us sort of the interactive potential of a city. But size is very predictive of economic performance, for example. Most of these cities have this predictability in knowing the economic performance of some of these cities relative to others. What is not predictable or is less predictable is how dense these cities are. For example, by knowing New York, you won't necessarily know L.A. or Atlanta. So there are some things like that that are different, and there are, in some sense, accidents of history. But so far what we found is that these mostly have to do with the way the city is laid out in space. Almost anything that's socioeconomic is much more predictive. Cities, of course, exist on many different dimensions, and some dimensions, all these are tied in interesting ways. But it's interesting to see how what you'd expect is that it's the ultimate reasons for cities to exist that are conserved. And so these are the ones that you see indeed being conserved in terms of economic and cultural productivity and infrastructure being essentially a means to an end. There are different means that usually people prefer, for example, like living at lower densities. And those are the ones that will be realized, even if they come at an increased cost in terms of the energy and expense that is implied on everybody.
Well, Dr. Luis Bettencourt, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
You're with Future Tense, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. We're available as a podcast via iTunes and ABC Online, and our name on Twitter is RNFutureTense, all one word.
I don't know about you, but sometimes city life feels a little bit like being stuck inside one of those old-fashioned pinball machines. And I'm pretty sure it sometimes feels that way to Phaedra Boinodiris. She's the lead designer for a game called City One.
This is IBM's very first step into the world of city simulations. We wanted to create an online experience that, in essence, walked game players through the decisions that a mayor or a company leader would need to make to be able to evolve their industry and evolve their municipalities. So we created this game with a number of different challenges that the gamer would need to go through to be able to reach their goals.
Now, what's important to know about City One is that if you choose to play, you don't just hop on and do what you want. Instead, you have certain scenarios and challenges set for you.
You might be familiar with the game SimCity. This is quite different from other city sims that are out there in the entertainment world, where you create a city from scratch. With this game, you're actually given a city with a certain set of problems. So, for example, your city is impacted by flooding. For example, they had a very bad storm, and your sewers are about to overflow, and it might affect your drinking water. What do you do? So real kinds of problems that are affecting real cities around the world today. We took events from case studies, problems from case studies that are affecting municipalities around the world, and showed how different kinds of solutions might be able to impact that problem, and also how these solutions depend upon one another, so that when you want to advance your municipality or your city to become smarter, how is it that these technologies go and build upon one another for your city to get there?
Now, tell us about your target constituency or audience, I guess you'd say. You want people to have fun, I presume, when they're playing this. You want it to be interesting. But who are you targeting? Are you looking for more than just a general audience? Are you specifically looking at people who are involved in things like city planning, local government, business, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Local government, city planning, business leaders, students, professors, but also the general public as well. There's a lot of really great and important information within this game, and we found that putting this kind of information within a medium like a game really lends to people's understanding of what the impacts are of these different solutions. How is it that these problems might affect different systems within different businesses in a city? And also, how is it that people might be able to collaborate around the solutions themselves, all within the game?
So you see real benefits for this approach in terms of getting us to better understand our urban environment.
To be able to understand the benefits of this approach, if you've ever tried to explain to somebody what a smart grid is, it's not the easiest concept to be able to get across. You know, what are the dependencies? How is it that the town where I live in Apex, North Carolina, why is it that I cannot be able to buy an electrical vehicle and plug it directly into a smarter grid that's being facilitated by the city? What this game shows is, what are the impacts? How does a city grow to be able to reach that particular goal? If they do want to be able to sustain a smarter grid, what are the steps along the way? What are the trade-offs as well? And being able to show this in a way that's unique and also enables some level of self-discovery really makes a difference in terms of the knowledge retention.
The game is part of a broader initiative at IBM called the Smarter Cities Challenge. How does it sit within that broader initiative?
Well, what we've done is we've got the online version of the game, but then we've also tied it into an online community so that we're introducing players to certain models of solutions within the game. And then, for example, if you want to, you can join the community to be able to discuss how these models or these solutions can be localized for your particular geography. So, for example, Let's say you've got a smarter grid that's being introduced within the game, or you've got a water management system. You can join an online community and discuss, okay, how would a water management system in Abu Dhabi differ from one in New Hampshire? You know, what are the geographic dependencies? How would these systems need to be different depending on where you are?
And I presume that's important, isn't it? Because there's a lot of commonalities between cities, but there are also a lot of specific differences.
Absolutely. It's extremely important. It gets even more complex when you think about how is it that these systems are interdependent. So, for example, if I go and I invest in my transportation infrastructure or invest in my environmental infrastructure, right, to invest in smarter energy, how does that affect healthcare, right? How does that affect public safety? I mean, what are these systems within a municipality, and how are they interdependent? How do they affect one another?
Now, the game was launched in October last year. How has it gone, and roughly how many players have you had participating?
It's gone very, very well. We've had players from all over the world playing the game, from a wide variety of different groups. For example, business leaders, city planners, city leaders, mayors, but also a number of students and schools are hopping online to learn about these systems and learning about the challenges affecting cities. Again, this was our very first step into the world of city sims. We really see wonderful potential in this medium, and we're very excited about seeing how we might be able to push the envelope even more in the world of serious games, and especially the notion of leveraging games to collaborate around solutions. So there'll be a lot more coming up.
And I'm going to jump back in at this point and say that we'll have a program on what's called gamification, the adaption of game dynamics for all sorts of real-world activities and applications, in just a few weeks' time. So stay tuned. And that was Phaedra Boinodiris, IBM's Interactive Media Manager and Lead Designer for CityOne. Go to our website if you want more details.
We wanted to explore a new form of feedback display in an urban rather than an isolated context that would visualize energy consumption to people in a meaningful way. So using technologies in a way that allows people to change their behavior in this specific context to reduce the energy consumption. And there have been a lot of projects, particularly research on human-technology interaction, that was concerned in the past with the design of such applications to encourage sustainable behavior. What we really wanted to try with this project was to design a form of localized feedback system which induces some forms of social pressure.
Dr. Martin Tomic from the Faculty of Architecture, Design and Planning at the University of Sydney. And the localised feedback system he and his colleagues designed involved taking residents of a particular street in the suburb of Darlington and getting them to list their daily electricity consumption on giant blackboards screwed to the front of their houses.
The idea was really to use the house facade as a platform for visualisation, and rather than using expensive electronic displays that themselves would use a lot of energy as well, we came up with this idea of using chalkboards, or a material that has very similar characteristics to chalkboard, simply because it fit better the architectural context of terrace houses, and also because there are many attributes of chalkboards that were very beneficial for our design, as we assign attributes with chalkboards, like playfulness, for example. We all know chalkboards from our childhood, from activities like doodling or street graffiti.
And so on these chalkboards, every day, the people participating in this project had to put up their energy usage from the previous day. So they had to display it there for the rest of the street to see. So sort of open competition between the houses.
That's correct. It was intended as an open competition, a healthy competition between the houses, to allow some form of visualization that helps people to compare their own behavior. But in fact, they didn't have to put up the energy themselves. So one of our team was going there every day and updating all of the boards.
Now you say healthy competition, but how did the people involved in the test project, how did they respond in the end? Were there some who actually felt uncomfortable about the whole situation once it got underway?
There wasn't, actually. Everyone was feeling very comfortable about their having their energy data displayed to the public. And in fact, the results actually showed that people had less privacy concerns than we assumed initially. So when we were designing the public display, we were really making sure that we wouldn't violate any privacy aspects or not to display any privacy-related data. So, for example, we were showing change rather than absolute consumption so that it would reveal less of what was actually happening in the household. But to our surprise, some people weren't actually that concerned with having the energy data on the displays.
Did the people who were involved in the project, did they in the end feel that it was a motivator for them to actually decrease their energy usage?
We are still analysing the data that we collected. So we collected both quantitative and qualitative data in the study. So we are still analysing this data. But the results are promising so far. And there are indications that there is actually an effect of having this public display of your energy consumption.
Now, I can imagine some people listening to this would say that in a sense, this isn't just about public display, it's about public shaming, or could be about public shaming. What would you say to that?
I addressed this issue or this concern in the design phase already by really carefully designing the way how we represented the information to the public, by making sure to keep it playful in a way, while at the same time meaningful, both for the people living in the house, but also for people walking past. It was also because we changed the data every day, so it was always reflected. It was reflected in the past 24 hours, and the ranking changed every day as well. So in a way, participants had very much control of what went up on the display. So we didn't find any issues of this triggering aspects of shame.
A blackboard on the front of your house telling all your neighbours just how much energy you and your family consume each day. Now, that's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. But Dr. Tomich and his team are currently looking for funding to replicate their experiment on a larger scale. Now, our final guest today is Dr. Andy Hudson-Smith from the Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis at University College London. He likes to talk to buildings, not in a slightly strange Prince Charles kind of way, but through a system of electronic tagging that he's devised, which he hopes will allow people to better understand the history and uniqueness of their immediate urban environment. His research project involves encouraging people to put a digital tag on buildings and other pieces of architecture to record place, space and time. Andy Hudson-Smith.
I really like the fact that we've been able to make buildings talk. So these little tags talk to our website, which is talesofthings.com. And there's an iPhone app, there's an Android app. And if you point your phone at these little tags, the architecture will talk back. But the interesting thing is that we've made these tags read-write. So as soon as you read one, it thinks you own the object you've just scanned, and it allows you to record a message back. So it's sort of like a mix between Facebook, Foursquare, the Antiques Roadshow, and eBay. An interesting little mix.
So, interesting indeed. So, just in terms of practicality, say, if I was to walk around London, I could get to various buildings, I could use my smartphone, and I could read the tag on those various buildings and find out a little bit about their history.
Yes, you could find out why they're there, you could find out photographs from the past, but it's also looking at a social network point of view. So we've just turned on 4,200 transport links in Norway, and they've got little QR codes. And the nice thing about that is that you can read the QR code. It will tell you how long you've got to wait for your next bus. And it also allows you to write back your thoughts. And it's fascinating to see bus stops tweeting, because every time there's a tag there, the architecture, the place, can actually tweet back.
So if I was, in the City of London and I went to a building, say a church, I could read what was, the history of say, that church from my phone. Could I then also make an entry? Could I say, look, I was married in this church in 2002, and then that becomes part of the social history of that particular building?
how it works is that you point your phone at the app and you can either type in text or you can record movie clips, and that will always live with that place and that tag. And the only way it can ever be played back is if you're in the actual location. So we're trying to move away from the website and get back to sort of place, space, and making things a lot more social.
So what's the benefit of this? You know, is there a benefit more than just the fun aspect, the interest aspect of it all?
Yeah, I definitely think there is. We walk through places now and we don't think of their past. Whereas from now on, every bit of architecture, every place, every space can record memories and record thoughts. So whereas it's very new now, in 50 years' time, there will be an amazing history that we can just play back. And it'll be really nice just to walk around either St. Paul's or your local church or your local library and see who has used it 20 years ago, to see them actually talking about the place.
Now, am I right in saying that this is really, I guess, a progression on it? It's part of the development of an interesting concept that we covered on the program a couple of years back, of the Internet of Things, where things are tagged and therefore they can talk to each other. We have objects around the world that will be connected, will have connectivity.
Yeah. The nice thing is that it's not just architecture, it's literally everything you own. So I've been tagging basically my entire flat. And the nice thing is that all of these things are geolocated too. So on our site, we have a section called the World of Things. So we can do the geography of everything in the world now. And all these things can begin to communicate and talk because they know where they are, and therefore they know where other things around them are. And because they're linked to the web just via simple low-cost QR codes, it's beginning to make some sort of social object network.
Is there a danger, though, I suppose, that if too many things are linked in that way, that they lose their value, that what ends up happening is we just have white noise, in a sense?
We've actually found that they're worth more. We've found that if you put things online, for example, if you have a watch, you're going to sell your watch online, it might be worth a certain price. But if it comes with a little tag which tells you who owned the watch, has a little movie clip of where the watch was made, and allows you to then record back and say, this is now my watch, when you sell it on, it's actually worth more because you're putting memories into the actual thing. So it actually makes us value things more, I think, than less.
What an interesting world it is. Dr. Andy Hudson-Smith from the Centre for Advanced Spatial Analysis at University College London. And before we go, let me tell you about a program that airs this Sunday on The Night Air on ABC Radio National. It's about a Japanese scientist at the Advanced Telecommunications Research Institute in Kyoto and his work on very human-like robots called Geminoids.
In April 2010, Professor Ishiguro and the Kokoro Company produced the Geminoid F, an android replica of a young Japanese woman. The Geminoid F is able to convincingly smile, frown, look sad, and surprised. The Geminoid F, together with the teleoperating system, is being sold commercially by the Kokoro Company. The Geminoid F is...
That's the strange world of Japanese robotics. This Sunday at 8:30 p.m. on The Night Air, right here on ABC Radio National.